Today in Your Health, we have a very close listen to the words we choose to speak. The way you use those words may reveal more about you than you know. One way to discover that is to hear people talk in a speed dating session. NPR's Elise Spiegel has this encore presentation.
Okay, women sit facing me, men sit facing the window. We have about 30 men and 30 women right now.
It's Friday night, and 30 men and 30 women have come to a Bland Hotel restaurant in downtown Washington looking for love. For the next 2 hours, they will talk to people they do not know, one after another, in 3-minute increments.
Where the women are seated, they'll stay the whole time. The men we're going to have rotate every 3 minutes from table 1 to 2, 2 to 3, and so on.
Michael Carlin, the guy who runs speed dating for professionals in the city, lays out the rules for the room. Explains that everyone should note down their favorites on the lined piece of paper that professionals in the city has provided. Explains that he'll be reading off funny questions before every date to help people spice up their conversation. And then he kicks it off.
Go ahead, start talking to who you're matched up with.
Now, as soon as Carlin does this, the room fills. Fills with this incredible wall of words. Just listen to it. What are these people saying, and what can we learn from what they're saying? About 20 years ago, a psychologist at the University of Texas at Austin named James Pennebaker got interested in looking more closely at the words that we use. Or rather, he got interested in looking more closely at a certain subset of the words that we use.
The, this, though, I...
This is Pennebaker reading off a list of the kind of words that particularly interest him. They're called function words.
Function words are essentially the filler words.
Very.
These are the words we don't pay attention to, and they're the ones that are so interesting. Who, there, that.
Now, according
hour,
to the way that Pennebaker organizes
fairly,
language,
five,
there's another set of words.
Content words.
These content words, Pennebaker says, are heftier. Unlike function words, they actually conjure a specific image in your mind. He reads some examples.
School, family, live, friends. Well, the way I think about it is I speak bad Spanish.
Children,
and
hard,
if I'm in a conversation,
parents,
when I'm listening to the other person speak,
twice,
I am just trying to find out what
remember,
are they talking about.
New,
I'm
mother,
listening to what, where, when,
God,
those big
mind,
content-heavy man, words.
Child,
all those little
young,
words in between,
days,
the, is, etc. I don't pay attention
small,
to those because they're just too complex for me to pay attention to.
In fact, says Pennebaker, even in our native language, these function words are basically invisible to us.
You can't hear them, even though you and I are talking. You and I are not processing what the other person says in terms of these function words. Humans just aren't able to do it.
Humans aren't able to do it, but computers are. Which is why, in the early 90s, Pennebaker and some graduate students sat themselves down and wrote themselves a computer program that could instantly count and categorize every word that it encountered. They then used this program to ask all kinds of questions. Could you tell if someone was lying by carefully analyzing the way that they used function words? Looking only at a transcript, could you tell from function words whether someone was male or female, rich or poor? And what about relationships? What could you tell by looking at the way two people spoke to each other?
Go ahead, start talking to who you're matched up with.
Which brings us back to speed dating. See, one of the things that Pennebaker did was transcribe conversations that took place between people on speed dates to see how the couples used function words. This is what he found.
We can predict, by analyzing their language, who will go on a date, who will match at rates better than the people themselves.
Specifically, what Pennebaker found was that in the speed dating context, when the language style of two people matched, that is, when they used these function words in similar ways at similar rates, they were much more likely to contact each other later to go on a date.
And, this is even cooler, we can even look at if we are dating, let's say we're a young dating couple, the more similar we are using this language style matching metric, the more likely you and I will still be dating 3 months from now.
Why? Turns out this isn't because similar people are attracted to each other. Pennebaker says they can be quite different. But when we are around people that we have a genuine interest in, our language subtly shifts.
When two people are paying close attention, they use language the same. And it's one of these things that humans do automatically.
They aren't aware of it, but if you look at their language carefully, you can see it. Now, Pennebaker has counted words to better understand lots of things, but I want to share his work on one subject in particular because I found it fascinating. He says that by analyzing people's use of function words, you can easily tell who among two people has more power in a relationship, their relative social status.
And it's amazingly simple. Listen to the relative use of the word I. And the results are completely different from what most people would think. The person who is the higher status uses the word I less.
To demonstrate this, Pennebaker actually brought in some of his own email.
These are emails that I wrote long before I started studying status. So I was not manipulating this to make me look good or bad.
And again, we're listening to how people in different power positions use the word I.
So here's an email that I received from an undergraduate named Pam. Dear Dr. Pennebaker, I was part of your introductory psychology class last semester. I have enjoyed your lectures and I've learned so much.
You get the idea. That was Pam. Now listen to an excerpt from Pennebaker's response.
Dear Pam, this would be great. This week isn't good because of a trip. How about next Tuesday between 9 and 10:30?
Pam, the lowly undergraduate, used the word I many times.
5 times in 40 words.
And you use the word I?
0, not at all.
Now listen to how Pennebaker uses the word I when he writes a famous professor.
Dear famous professor, the reason I'm writing is that I'm helping to put together a conference. I would absolutely love it if you could come.
When famous professor wrote back, not a single I. Pennebaker says, we use I more when we talk to someone with power. Because we're more self-conscious, we are focused on ourselves and how we are coming across. And our language reflects that. I emerges.
Your attention naturally goes inward.
And how consciously are we doing it?
Not at all.
So could we use these insights to change ourselves? Like Eliza Doolittle in My Fair Lady, could we bend our personalities by bending the words that we use? Could we be stronger, more powerful? After 20 years of looking at this stuff, Pennebaker doubts it.
These words reflect who we are more than drive who we are.
So you can't change who you are by changing your language. You can only change your language by changing who you are.
I think that's generally true.
Pennebaker has collected some of his research in a book called The Secret Life of Pronouns, but says he feels the practice of using computers to count and categorize language is really just at the beginning. It's like we just invented the telescope, he tells me, and there are a million new places to look. Elise Spiegel, NPR News, Washington.
One Saturday night this summer, a foreigner was riding the subway in Shanghai. The subway rider fainted and fell to the floor. And then something striking happened. Other passengers around the man scattered. Not a single person tried to help. When the train arrived at the next station, apparently terrified commuters stampeded out of the car.
Closed circuit video captured this incident. We've been watching it here this morning. And this video has added to a debate among Chinese about their national character, not to mention trust and fear in modern society. NPR's Frank Langfitt reports from Shanghai.
We are now at Changping Road. Doors were open on the right.
I'm on Shanghai's main subway line, line number 2. That's where the man fainted. And I've been asking people what they thought of the videotape, which tens of millions of Chinese have already seen now.
Everyone is hoping someone else will take care of him. Everyone is waiting for someone else to react. But no one takes the initiative to help.
Wang Jianlian is 24 years old, and he works on components for electric cars. He appears anguished as he tries to explain the behavior.
It's probably because there is an inherent weakness, a mentality that permeates Chinese society. No one wants to be dragged into things that aren't their business. People want to trust, but given what's happened in the past, they have no choice but to be skeptical.
What happened in the past is this infamous scam. An elderly person collapses in public. When someone tries to help, the senior citizen accuses him or her of knocking him down and then demands money. Yun Shang-yen, a UCLA anthropologist, has studied 26 of these cases. He says the scam has received so much attention.
Even the Chinese government issued a document warning people who wanted to help, find yourself a witness before you offer a hand to make sure the person being helped will not be able to accuse you and extort you.
Yan is writing a book on morality in China. He says the scams and a reluctance to help those you don't know is rooted in a traditional way some Chinese still view relationships.
How to treat strangers nicely is one of the biggest challenges in contemporary Chinese society, because prevailing ethical systems in traditional China is based on close-knit community ties, kinship ties.
Yan says in traditional agrarian society, Chinese sharply divided people between those they knew and those they didn't.
A person might treat other people in the person's group, social group, very, very nicely, but turn around when facing to a stranger tend to be very suspicious and whenever possible might take advantage of that stranger.
That might help explain why some people didn't help the man who fainted on the subway, but not why everyone fled. Back on line two, a young woman named Zhao has another theory.
It's probably because now the social environment is too unsafe, which gives people an unstable feeling. So if there's an emergency, everyone is scared their lives might be threatened. Then they run.
Zhao is referring to a pair of knife attacks and a suicide bombing at train stations this year. According to state media, after the man fainted on the Shanghai subway, a passenger shouted, "Something's happened," and that may have triggered the stampede. But a man named Zhang thinks Chinese people are getting a bad rap. He says he rides Line 2 every day, and people routinely help others if they faint.
The fact that this foreigner fainted and nobody helped was an accident. People suspected the foreigner had that African illness, so at this time, people just weren't willing to help him. The point I want to make is, this city is not that cold.
Zhang is referring to Ebola. I point out the foreigner was a white guy. Zhang says, well, he could have traveled from Africa. Yan, the UCLA anthropologist, says older people here seem the least concerned with the well-being of strangers, but he sees a lot of hope with the younger generation.
I think overall the society is going to a more positive direction, and mainly due to demographic shift.
Yan says young people here have grown up in a more globalized society with more inclusive values.
In my own research, I have cases where the youth donate money to earthquake victims after the 2008 big quake. And some of them simply went there to be a volunteer.
As more young Chinese are exposed to the world, Yan expects them to continue to adopt a newer, more modern notion, empathy. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Shanghai.
Most of us do not enjoy going to the doctor's office, but it turns out you can earn money doing that. Standardized patients are people who take on fake identities and health issues in order to help train medical students. As part of our series on odd jobs for teens, Maine Public Radio's Patty White introduces us to one teenager who says this odd job is a perfect match for her.
Some of us are lucky enough to stumble into jobs that we love. That was the case for 16-year-old Gabrielle Nuki. She never heard of standardized patients until her advisor at school told her she should check it out.
I was kind of shocked, and I was kind of like, oh, is there actually something like this in the world?
Nuki wants to be a doctor someday, so the chance to earn $15 to $20 an hour training medical students as a pretend patient was kind of a dream come true. Every 6 weeks or so, Nuki comes to Maine Medical Center in Portland, slips on a Johnny, sits in an exam room, and takes on a new persona.
Hey there, Emma.
Third-year medical student Ali Tetro knows Nuki by her fictional patient name Emma. A lot of teens avoid the doctor, so it's important for Tetro to learn how to make them feel comfortable.
What kind of things do you like to do outside of school?
I play soccer, and so preseason's coming up soon.
Nuki preps weeks ahead of time for her patient roles. She memorizes a case history of family details, lifestyle habits, and the tone she should present.
I've had one case where I was concerned about being pregnant. That was kind of the most, harsh one, I guess.
As Emma, Nuki's playing just a shy, healthy teen.
How'd school finish up for you this year?
It was good. School's been good.
It's an easy role, Nuki says, but she ups the shyness factor because it poses a classic challenge to the medical student, how to get a teen to open up.
Each case kind of has what's on paper, but then you can come in and kind of add another level, and depending on how complex it is already, but you can add kind of your own twist to it.
After asking Emma about her personal history, Ali Tetra moves on to the physical exam and listens as Emma takes deep breaths. Tetra gives a clean bill of health and the practice appointment is over. But the most important part of Gabrielle Nuki's job is about to begin. The 16-year-old now has to evaluate this adult professional. She's smooth and tactful after lots of training on how to deliver feedback. Nuki tells Tetra she did a good job making her feel comfortable.
I also liked how you mentioned confidentiality because my age group, that's important to touch on. And I think that maybe you could have had a couple more times where you asked me if I had any questions. But other than that, I think you did a really great job.
It's communication skills versus acting skills that really qualify someone to be a standardized patient, says Dr. Pat Patterson, the director of pediatric training at Maine Medical Center.
A lot of times patients really want to please their physician. So it's not easy for a patient to say, that didn't feel right, or the way you asked that made me feel badly.
Gabrielle Nuki says working with medical students and being forthright about their performance has given her more confidence. In the future, she hopes to take on more complex roles, maybe someone with depression. But she knows no matter what kind of patient she portrays, this job will prepare her well for when she reverses roles and one day becomes a doctor. For NPR News, I'm Patty White.
Now to a story that challenges some common advice about dieting. In recent years, nutrition scientists have been rethinking fat. Many have concluded it's not the enemy we've been led to believe it is. Not for our hearts, not for our waistlines. NPR's Allison Aubrey tells us about a new study that adds to the evidence.
Lots of people, including me, once assumed that if you ate fatty foods, say avocados, nuts, full-fat dairy, or oily salad dressings, that you'd get fat.
We've been told for decades that if you don't want fat on your body, don't put fat into your body. It's a very appealing notion. The problem is, it's wrong.
That's David Ludwig of Harvard Medical School and Boston Children's Hospital. Back in 2012, he published a study in the Journal of the American Medical Association, which was one nail in the coffin for the low-fat diet paradigm. His study showed that when people add in lots of healthy fats to their diets and take out refined carbohydrates, such as bagels and crackers, which had become staples of low-fat eating, they did better, including on measures of heart health.
We saw improvements in HDL cholesterol and the possibility of lowered chronic inflammation.
And there was another advantage. The higher fat, lower carb approach seemed to rev up people's metabolism. Ludwig found that those who stopped eating so much starch burned off about 150 more calories a day compared to people eating a high carb, lower fat diet.
Too much refined carbohydrates, white bread, white rice, potato products, all those foods that have crept into our diets as we've followed the low fat craze, has undermined our metabolism and caused us to become hungrier and, ironically, burn off fewer calories.
What's thought to happen in the body is this. Too many refined carbs send a signal to the body to release a lot of insulin. That extra insulin locks up calories inside fat cells where they cannot be used for energy.
So that's a recipe for both increased hunger, but also feelings of fatigue and tiredness. It's a double whammy for weight gain.
So this brings us to a new study published today. Researchers at Tulane University tracked what happened over a one-year-long period when overweight men and women, a diverse mix including African Americans and Caucasians, followed a low-carb approach. Study leader Lydia Bazzano says once you swap out bready carbs, what you're swapping in is more protein and more fat. So what kinds of meals were they eating?
Typically in the morning, they were eating eggs. We had a lot of recipes with eggs in them.
And for lunch and dinner, the low-carb dieters were directed to eat lots of vegetables, salads, proteins, including fish and meat, prepared with generous portions of healthy fats.
olive oils, canola oils, vegetable oils,
as well as small amounts of butter and other animal fat. In total, fat made up a sizable portion of their overall calories, in the range of 40 to 43%. Now, Bassano says many people might say, this doesn't sound like a weight loss diet with all the fat.
It's not the general perception.
Yet, when she tracked how much weight the low-carb dieters lost over 1 year, it averaged about 12 pounds. This compared to only about 4 pounds of weight loss for those following a low-fat diet, even though the two groups were eating about the same number of calories.
It's more than double, yes. So this was, yes, surprising.
And it offers more evidence that when it comes to right-sizing our waistlines, it's refined carbs, more so than fat, that many Americans could cut back on. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Hollywood's had a humdrum summer at the box office. In fact, until Guardians of the Galaxy came along, the film industry was looking at its lowest attendance figures in more than a decade. But hope springs eternal, and there's always fall. So we asked our critic Bob Mondello for a selective preview of the coming season.
You know what's not on the fall movie list? Not even once? A straight-up superhero movie. There is a movie about an actor who once played a superhero and who is now so down on his luck he's fantasizing about a return to stardom while balanced on a roof edge high above the street.
You're Birdman. Yeah! You are a god.
Hey, is this for real or are you shooting a film?
A film!
You people are full of crap.
Music.
He has written a play called Birdman.
He's a Hollywood clown in a lycra bird suit.
Yes, he is. But he's going out on that stage and risking everything.
It's about being respected and validated. Remember, that's what you told me.
That's Michael Keaton, who, as a one-time Batman, knows a little something about what the hero's facing in Birdman. While there won't be other superheroes in theaters, there will be plenty of regular heroes and a heroine or two, including a Hunger Games gladiator who's become a symbol of resistance.
Any association with the Mockingjay symbol is forbidden.
Yeah, well, forbid all you want. Jennifer Lawrence's Katniss is not hearing it in Hunger Games Mockingjay Part 1.
Are you fighting, Katniss? Are you here to fight with us?
I am. I will.
Heroics elsewhere this fall will occasionally be historical and require not physical but intellectual prowess. The Imitation Game gives us Benedict Cumberbatch as British mathematician Alan Turing, who basically had to invent a computer during World War II to help the Allies break the Germans' Enigma code.
Everyone thinks Enigma is unbreakable.
Let me try, and we'll know for sure.
Turing was not what you'd call a team player.
Gentlemen, meet Mr. Turing.
We ought to work together, then. I'm afraid these men would only slay me down.
Popular at school, way.
Still, he achieves great things, as does a humbler but no less brilliant Englishman in The Theory of Everything, a physics genius who must battle not just his physics department, but his physical condition.
It's called motor neuron disease. Life expectancy is 2 years.
That diagnosis came when he was 21. He's lived another 50 years already, though not without setbacks.
He has pneumonia. The only way he would survive would be to give him a tracheotomy. He will never speak again.
Yes, he will.
My name is Stephen Hawking.
It's American.
Is that a problem?
I don't mean to suggest that there won't be Rock'em Sock'em movie heroics this fall. Some severely damaged leading men will be living up to Hollywood stereotypes, rescuing damsels in distress. Liam Neeson as a non-recovering alcoholic in A Walk Among the Tombstones.
I've done this before. We're going to do it again.
Denzel Washington as the Equalizer.
Me about a girl.
And Ben Affleck wants to see himself as the good guy in Gone Girl, but he ends up the chief suspect.
I had nothing to do with the disappearance of my wife.
And then there's a story about a woman who doesn't seem to want to be rescued, a romance called The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby that has a structural gimmick in the storytelling. It looks at a relationship from the guy's point of view and also from the gal's. In a car during a downpour, here's Eleanor Rigby's take.
You're sopping wet.
You noticed that?
And here's how her boyfriend heard that exchange.
You're sopping wet.
Oh, you noticed. Thank you.
Trouble in Paradise? It is called The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby. Other films with storytelling gimmicks included Teen Dystopia, The Maze Runner, and David Cronenberg's latest industry in-joke, Maps to the Stars. All of that fantasy is balanced this fall by a lot of true stories about headline makers, Channing Tatum and Steve Carell in the thriller Foxcatcher, based on a tragic 1990s combo of money, sports, and mental illness.
We're going to do great things, Mark.
I'm going to give you everything I have.
Also, Jimmy, All Is By My Side, in which rapper Andre 3000 plays an up-and-comer named Hendrix.
I want my music to go inside the soul of a person.
Tracks, about a woman who made a solo trek across 1,700 miles of Australian outback.
When people ask me why I'm doing it, my usual answer is why not.
And Rosewater, the directing debut of Jon Stewart, about a writer who appeared on The Daily Show and then...
You are a spy.
Ended up in an Iranian prison.
Who are you working for?
The CIA?
Who is Anton Chekhov?
Anton Chekhov? The playwright?
Yeah, you tell me. It is you who has listed an interest of him on Facebook.
And although the plot in Fury, Brad Pitt's tank crew drama, is pure fiction.
Never even seen the inside of a tank.
The tank itself is real, borrowed from a museum and reportedly the first World War II Tiger tank ever to grace a film set. Sound a little heavy? Well, even the fall's comedies sometimes center on serious issues. Suicide in The Skeleton Twins, starring Bill Hader and Kristen Wiig.
I get depressed about my life.
So you're not a famous actor? I got news for you. No one's a famous actor.
George Clooney is a famous actor.
Okay, George Clooney, I guess that's one exception.
Demolishing Stereotypes is the point of a campus satire called Dear White People.
I read your entire 15-page unsolicited treatise on why the Gremlins is actually about suburban white fear of black culture.
The Gremlins are loud, talk in slang, are addicted to fried chicken, and freak out when you get their hair wet.
And the fact-based comedy Pride is sort of a twofer about both striking coal miners and the gay group that raises money to help them.
What I was told about lesbians can't be true, can they? You're all vegetarians.
More serious takes on social issues include The Judge, a passion project for producer and star Robert Downey Jr., Frontera, in which Michael Peña is caught up in an immigration scandal, and Whiplash, a Sundance Film Festival crowd pleaser about a young jazz musician.
Here we go. 5, 6, and.
Who gets bullied by his music teacher.
Were you rushing or were you dragging?
I don't know.
If you deliberately sabotage my band, I will gut you like a pig.
Back to school with a vengeance. And while I'm talking back to school, parents will be relieved to know that after a summer notably lacking in family films, the fall has 5 kid flicks before Thanksgiving. The Box Trolls, about a boy being raised by timid critters underground.
No more hiding, right? Right.
Big Hero 6, about a kid with an inflatable semi-super pal.
What's wrong with you?
Low battery.
A resilient youngster in Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day.
We are not going to let this day get the better of us.
An assertive princess in The Book of Life.
Did I mention I studied fencing?
What?
And those ever-traveling penguins of Madagascar.
We've arrived in the center of Dublin, Ireland.
We gotta blend in. Riverdance.
And while the kids are being treated to affirmation and adventure, Dark Knight director Christopher Nolan will be scaring their parents half to death with a vision of a world that's run out of food in Interstellar.
We must confront the reality that nothing in our solar system can help us.
Now you need to tell me what your plan is to save the world.
That gets us to Thanksgiving, after which the awards contenders come out to play, Broadway musicals, biblical epics, hobbits. But we're out of time, so we'll save those for another day. I'm Bob Mandela.